I don't wanna go to work. I just wanna chill and play all day. Look him dead in the face and say, I wish I could just be still asleep while you work.
Welcome to season 4 of the Jobs Blow podcast. I'm your host, Brianna Haas, here once again to share inspiring stories about getting ahead. This week's show is called The Art of Reporting with Stephanie Simon of New York One News. Stephanie covers art and culture in all its many forms across the 5 boroughs, including the visual arts, jazz, the New York Philharmonic, New York history, and everything in between. So nice to meet you, Stephanie.
Thanks for having me, Brianna.
I know we did speak a little bit about the Met Gala happening last night, and you did not cover it. Are you feeling a little jealous that you weren't able to be there?
I'm not feeling jealous because as much as I've enjoyed doing it over time, it is a tough night on the carpet. As you know, it's so many celebrities. It's so hard to get really great interviews that night because there's so much press lined up and down the stairwell. And the truth is, you could find those exact same celebrities over the next 3 weeks at dozens of red carpets, film premieres, and get great interviews and spend a little more time and get what you want from the A-listers. But it is a fun night, as you know. But bravo to everyone who went there.
But I, looking at the pictures, it didn't feel as like big Hollywood to me as it used to. And it could be just because I'm a bit of a Kardashian snob. Like I can't take them seriously. I'm not a big fan of reality television. And for me, when they show up, it just, I don't know. I grew up in the, you know, 90s, especially when it was Renee Zellweger and Charlize Theron and Nicole Kidman and Tom Hanks. And those to me are celebrities. And I just really have a hard time with these people that I don't really think as, I don't know, celebrities.
But it's always been a bit of an evolution when we think about these kinds of events. Now, this ball in particular celebrates celebrity and fashion. But over time, we've seen these kind of events were originally for society types. Then you'd go to a fashion show and the front row was all society people, right, not celebrities. Then they were sort of usurped by movie stars and TV stars. Then models and other kinds of celebrities started to infiltrate those front rows. Now it's influencers and social media stars. So it has always kind of had this moving evolution of who is in the front row and who's walking the carpet. But you're right, there is a different feel. Some of the older people watching might not know some of the TikTok stars who would have been there last night. And they might not know some of the young movie stars either, but a lot of big, big names. And I saw John Batiste, who I love, and
I
he's having such
him,
a big year. And so kudos to him and a lot of great outfits. And it is about being over the top and being out there and not being conservative. And I think that's always fun to see too.
Well, I do have to say, even though I'm not a fan of the Kardashians, Pete certainly cleans up nicely. It's clear there's been some effort into his new look.
If you're going to look good, you're going to do it that night. You're not going to wait for another event.
Right. Well, he actually, the DC Correspondents' Dinner, he's got a light beard going on or something. It just, you could tell he's been manicured.
Yes, I could see you're crushing a little bit. I like it.
Yeah. Well, I like Pete. He seems like a decent person. Anyway, so we're here to talk about you, and you are celebrating 25 years with New York One, right?
Absolutely. Yes, my silver anniversary.
Which is incredible, especially for someone like myself, who, as I was telling you, has made it maybe 4 years anywhere. So congratulations. That's
Thank
an achievement.
You.
And it's an achievement in any career, but especially with the news. You know, we talked a little bit about how difficult it can be for a woman in the news.
And it's a tough field in general. And the truth is, a lot of people never get to what you would consider mid-career because it's a lot of work. It's hard to have a personal life or start a family, not just TV and journalism in general. And a lot of people move out from that kind of day in and day out. And as you know, move over into PR. Maybe they're going to be hired as a spokesperson for the mayor's office or some other city agency. And even when you think about the scope of a career, there's always a massive exodus before people even get to what would be considered mid-career, because it's tough and it tends to be a young person's game because it is challenging to stay with it.
Right. And so you started there in 97. And when you started, you were a features reporter?
No, I started as a hard news producer, and I had a background as a radio reporter and anchor, mostly doing hard and breaking news. And that's what I came to New York One to do. And it was an interesting evolution because I had my background in hard news and people kept asking me to work on features projects. And I remember thinking, huh, I wonder if I'm not doing the hard news thing right. It's just so strange. I haven't had this happen before where I was being asked to work on features. And in fact, the first big assignment I was asked to do was to produce a special on the New York Philharmonic. And I thought, the New York Philharmonic? And I even said, me? Why? And I remember thinking, am I doing a bad job with the hard news? And someone said, no, well, you love music. You know so much about music. And I thought, I mean, the Beatles, yeah, but the Philharmonic. And they said, hey, just do it. It'll be great. And it was great. And I just fell in love with covering the arts. And after doing what I think was a great job with the Philharmonic special, they asked me to do something with jazz at Lincoln Center. And I remember having the same reaction. Jazz? Me? Why me? And the answer was, and you know this from jobs, you just have to not mess up the previous job, right? You have to just, you know. And so I said, jazz at Lincoln Center, why me? And they said, oh, well, you did it with the Philharmonic. Lincoln Center, jazz at Lincoln Center, same thing. Well, of course, we know it's not the same thing at all. And, you know, there's absolutely no overlap. But I took sort of the outline of what I did with the Philharmonic and applied it to jazz at Lincoln Center. And over time, I suggested to New York One to create an arts and culture beat that I would helm to have regular coverage. And so I switched from being a hard news producer to a features producer to a features reporter and anchor covering all the different aspects of the arts and culture scene, you know, comedy, fashion, theater, food, history, live entertainment, ballet, opera. I mean, you name it. I say it's arts and culture and I cover it.
So was George Whipple there already or did he?
Yeah, George was there doing red carpets and similar to what we were talking about. Originally, he was covering society events. We didn't necessarily say he was our celebrity reporter because a lot of what he covered were considered society events, garden parties and that sort of thing. And he's someone with an interesting story because he's also a lawyer by day. Right. And he was friends with Andy Warhol. And Andy Warhol is the person who said to him, George, you're in this world. Why don't you take your still camera and take photos of people you know of this world, of this society world and this arts world? And so like me, someone else saw something and said, why don't you do it this way? And George thought, here I was looking for a subject and it was right in front of my face, you know, to do this. And that was his evolution as well.
I just watched that Warhol documentary. Did you see it?
I haven't seen it yet.
Really interesting. Really interesting. So how long were you at New York One doing hard news before you moved into more of the arts and feature?
A year and a half.
Okay. So the reason I ask is I just didn't know if you were doing hard news when 9/11 happened.
I had moved into features, but like any person working in news at all, I spent the next year covering 9/11 and its aftermath exclusively, occasionally through the lens of the arts, through makeshift memorials, but typical of what you might think of from the time, going to firehouses, speaking to people who had survived, people talking to people who had lost loved ones, mental health stories. And I think New York One, we were wall to wall really for that first full year. And that's all I can remember covering for about a full year. And then I remember after the 1 year anniversary, feeling like it was time to not move on, but to not see everything through that lens. And the pandemic's been the same way, I think, in a lot of ways.
Well, I do remember Liz Smith because I was a big fan of hers back then. That she, I think the first column she did after it was, it's not time for gossip. It just doesn't feel right. But I have to ask, so when you had to make the switch back to hard news, and let's be honest, that's some hard news to report. were you grateful to go back to the art stuff? I mean, one of the reasons, and I told you that I was a broadcast major, but I didn't want to do hard news, was because it was so depressing and I would prefer to do the fun stuff. So yeah. I'm just wondering if it made you appreciate that you had made that change and happy to go back.
I was happy to go back. I do remember in the first few weeks and months after 9/11, where all my friends who didn't work in journalism felt a sort of depression where they just didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to help. I felt so glad to be able to have something to focus on and to tell stories and to tell those really hard, difficult stories. I felt like I was somehow part of the process and playing an important role. But you're right, over time, as I moved back into the arts, it was still 9/11, but through the arts lens. And I think the museums and the orchestras and the individual artists, they gave people a place to find healing, to find strength. And I actually think New Yorkers' relationship with the arts was reinvigorated and reimagined during that time. The New York Historical Society, MoMA, all of these places you may have never gone before, but people were flocking in to see these makeshift exhibits, something you would never see at MoMA or the New York Historical Society. You know, exhibits get planned out 3-5 years in advance. They don't do these ad hoc exhibitions, but that's what was happening in the city. Orchestras, musicians, poets, visual artists, everything was very much in the moment and responding to where New York was. And it was very moving to be part of that and to see New Yorkers lean into their institutions, and the institutions, instead of being these rarefied spaces where you might say, well, I don't belong here, I don't know that much about art, or I've never been to the Philharmonic before. I feel like there was a sense that the arts were there for them, for healing and for solace, for building a sense of community, and also rebuilding the economy, because the arts are such an important driver for New York City.
Right. And obviously, it's, to your point, the pandemic, here we are once again, and who suffered so greatly is the arts in the city.
Yeah, and you see a similar change comes with the pandemic. They're closed. You know, the performing arts are the first to close and last to open, but the museums and a lot of the other arts institutions reimagine themselves as places of civic engagement. They're doing COVID testing. They're doing food giveaways, clothing giveaways, offering translation services, all these things that are not what you would think of visiting a museum in the Bronx or Queens or Manhattan and all the boroughs. So there's, again, a reimagining of what these spaces can do, who they can help, who's welcome inside. And then again, the art and the music starts to respond to the current moment, instead of these exhibits and concerts that are planned out 5 and 10 years in advance. It's a real sense of trying to be nimble in responding to what's going on, because we were all in it together and that was part of it.
All right. Well, I want to turn back to your career journey. But before we do, I found a quote. I looked for a woman in broadcast for a powerful quote. So this is what I have. You have to find what sparks a light in you so that you, in your own way, can illuminate the world. And that was Oprah. And so I wanted to start off with that, because it seems to me you found something that sparked a light for you in your career. Because I mean, 25 years again at one place, clearly doing something that you're passionate about is a great way to kind of lead into your story. Your story, which I believe starts with you writing a gossip paper when you were in like first grade.
Yes, I was always very curious and inquisitive. And you could say my conversations with adults often came off as interviews. And at the time, I would hear a lot of adults say, oh, look, she's the next Rona Barrett. Of course, I didn't know who Rona Barrett was.
That's funny. I got Hedda Hopper.
Oh, okay. So
that's both, really going back.
Yeah, we both had this where, and again, it's what other people see in you and how they hold the mirror up to you. So when I was very young, it was, here's Rona Barrett. Rona Barrett's here to do her interview. So I really had the idea from a young age that I was already a journalist, that I was here to interview people and get their stories. So in first grade, I decided I have to have my own newspaper. And my local newspaper was called the Ambler Gazette. So I thought I would be clever and call mine the Gossip Gazette, which was very appropriate because I did make up a lot of it. You know, I made up the horoscope. I wrote the stories, but you know, a lot of the other, the forecast, I probably just made it up. But my whole family helped me. You know, my sister hand wrote some of it. My mom typed some of it. My dad collated it at his office. It was, you know, a family affair. And I did that for a few years growing up. And I was known as the person who handed out her Gossip Gazette newspaper.
Wow.
And it was really a thrilling start. And then when I was in high school, I wrote for the actual Ambler Gazette, which then was such a funny thing to do in a way. Nobody understood my enthusiasm for it to have this small column. But here I was, I had already made it in a way in my mind. And then I went to Temple University and studied broadcast journalism and made the move from print to broadcast, fell in love with radio. I thought, okay, no, now I'm in my place. I love radio. But then I moved to TV and I said, no, now I'm really where I belong. And I was doing hard news at New York One, as we talked about. But like you, I burnt out on it, but I'm not sure if I realized it was burnout. I started to feel like a lot of the stories started to feel the same. And as this opportunity came to start producing pieces on arts and culture, I did have that aha moment where I felt like I had had a lot of creativity that had been pent up that I didn't know was there. And I didn't know I would have a passion for the excitement of the arts and culture scene of New York City. And I think as I look back on it and what's made me successful and that spark, it's my enthusiasm. And it's still surprising to me that after an interview to this day, someone will say, no one's ever been that enthusiastic about my story. And I've been interviewed 100 times, or I've never been interviewed before. I never thought anyone would be interested in my story. And so I think that's what I bring. And I think that comes from picking your own stories. I think for those first few years, you know, you're assigned a car crash, a warehouse fire, all these breaking news moments. And there's an adrenaline there and a certain excitement that's built into breaking news. But that's a different animal. When you come up with your own story idea and you call someone and you can't believe how great their story is. And then you get there and their great story combines with your passion and enthusiasm. And I think that's what has made the story successful. They resonate. Other people are excited by my enthusiasm for the subject matter. And of course, I like to think I pick great characters and great stories. And I also think seeing it all through the lens of artists and comedians and creators offers people an insight, not just into the world of arts and culture, but into the world in general through a very palatable lens. You know, if you hear someone talking about the world, but they're strumming their guitar, it's different than watching a policymaker talk about it in a sort of dry arena.
So are you at a place after 25 years where other people put the packages together and you're still doing all the work?
I do most of it. I often shoot my own stories on my iPhone if I can. I did one last night, just showed up at a speakeasy and interviewed the leader of a swing band who's been doing it for a decade about her story. And sometimes I do go with a full crew for stories that are, you know, a lot more complicated than that. We did some fun behind the scenes pieces this past winter at Radio City Music Hall, or a big sit down interview with Wynton Marsalis. With those kind of assignments, I don't show up with the light gear and the slim production, but I edit a lot of it. I write everything myself. I write all my own stories and I develop all my own stories. I come up with all the story ideas and develop them.
And how many stories do you usually turn out a week?
It averages two. I would say during the pandemic, it could have been as much as 5, similar to after 9/11, quicker turns, longer days. But 2 to 3 stories a week is what's average for me. And I used to always say they can't both be masterpieces. I have to give a little less to one if I'm going to make the other great. But then when I would get to that second one, I'd say, no, this is also a masterpiece. I can't, you know, I fall in love with the person I'm interviewing and their whole story. And even though I say every time that I can't spend the extra 4 hours polishing it and making it perfect, of course I do, because I can't help myself.
So of all the interviews you've had in 25 years covering arts, what's a standout for you?
Well, I have a few, if you'll allow me. One that really stands out, and it's not truly an interview, but I do love this story. years ago, Paul McCartney had composed music for the New York City Ballet. And there was going to be a red carpet event. And they said all along, Paul McCartney's not doing interviews, but he'll walk and you'll get video of him. And then they came out right before he walked. And they said, Paul McCartney's not doing interviews, but you can get still shots. He'll pose for a few minutes. So all week I had it in my mind. What could I say to Paul McCartney that in a way he'd have to turn around and say something, but I don't want to say something wacky either.
Right.
So I had been reading that really the head of the ballet master, had been getting some criticism. Why is Paul McCartney composing the music? Does this make sense? And, you know, the ballet master had really gone out on a limb and really defended Paul McCartney and his artistry and how great of an artistic piece this was. But this wasn't just because Paul McCartney's Paul McCartney and he's famous. So as Paul McCartney walks the red carpet, I yell out, "What has the New York City Ballet done for your music, Paul?" And he slowly turns around and says, "A lot." And the entire red carpet went crazy. What did you ask him? What did you ask? What did he say? What did you ask him? What's a ballet master? You see, no one else there even knew the event they were covering. They only cared that he was a celebrity. And I did too. Of course, it's Paul McCartney and I want to get sound. But they didn't even understand the context of what I had yelled out. And the funniest part of it is I couldn't even use the whole long clip. As you know, you like to like drag the end of the shot, because I jumped in front of my own camera to let my cameraman know how excited I was and was like, I can't believe that. And I always said to myself, that's how you do it. You thought about it all week. It's not easy. People think a red carpet is easy. It's not. Sometimes you really have to plan and you really have to think about, I had 3 seconds. And again, I could have said something wacky too. And I know people do that on the red carpet. You've seen it, but that's not my style. And I would never do that. And I thought it was a very fair question.
So as having been on the red carpet, often I was there not for the event, but to ask other questions about their personal life or their personal hygiene. So you had the benefit of actually covering an event. You were there for that particular story, which obviously made it a little bit easier for you. I remember I was on a carpet once and they wanted me to ask, I think I've talked about this before, Claire Danes and Billy Crudup. It was for their movie where they met and he left his pregnant girlfriend. And they wanted me, I was there for In Touch. They wanted me to ask about that. And I was never so grateful that they didn't do media, because it would have been mortifying. I wouldn't even have been able to ask that question. I would have preferred to, like you, ask about the movie and the work. So, yes.
No. Yeah, and I've often been on the red carpet after an interview like what you're talking about. And then by the time the person gets in front of our mic, they're all flustered, they're stressed, or they're just like, does anyone know why I'm here today? You know, I don't want to talk about the anniversary of Whitney Houston's death or what I'm doing for Valentine's Day. Because as you know, a lot of places will ask you to ask questions to be used throughout the entire year.
Right.
And so as they're coming down the carpet, if you're not at the beginning, by the time they get to you, they can lose their enthusiasm for the event. But yes, it can help to actually know what you're covering and ask something that's germane to it.
So let me ask you, on the opposite end, worst interview.
Let's see. There's been some doozies. It has less to do with the actual interview, but when the Super Bowl was going to be in New Jersey quite a few years ago, they decided to build the Super Bowl Boulevard in Times Square. And it was supposed to be this amazing thing. Tens of thousands of people were going to converge on it. And through some connections, I was able to get an exclusive look at the build out as they were building it. And it was going to be totally exclusive. I don't know if you remember, but it was also this freezing weather. It had its own name. It wasn't El Nino. I can't remember. Oh, the polar vortex.
Yes.
So they told me for this exclusive, I could just go in and get like 30 seconds of video. And it's all I needed. Well, I go with my cameraman. I mean, it's so cold. Tears are just streaming down my face and they're freezing. It feels like little icicles. And we go and I tell my cameraman, we'll get 30 seconds. I'll say, here's this great thing. What an amazing view. Because you could walk up and see the whole boulevard they were building. And they took us on a half hour tour. No, don't you want to see this other thing?
Oh, geez.
And I couldn't feel my feet. I couldn't feel my face. I couldn't feel my hands. But what was I going to do? Cut it short? It was this amazing exclusive. We weren't dressed appropriately for a half hour outside. I was so cold. I was cold for days thinking about it. And that cameraman to this day will just once in a while, like, kind of look at me and just say, like, polar vortex. I still owe him. He's still a little upset about it.
Was he a football fan at least? I mean, was he there?
I think he was. I think he thought it was fun. But when you go in for a 30-second outdoor shoot and you're there for a half hour, so that was tough. You know, other times when people just give you those one word answers and you're live and, hey, what do you think of this great event? It's nice. Why are you excited to be here? I don't know.
I was paid. I was paid.
Yeah, exactly. Well, my publicist told me I should come.
Well, yeah. And often people who are good actors, it doesn't mean that that translates when they don't have lines. Sometimes, you know.
Yeah. I was at a red carpet and there was also a protest nearby. And a lot of the celebrities, it was at the Met Opera, and a lot of the celebrities came, and it was obvious they also didn't understand what the protest was about. And so they all kind of skirted it. One opera singer, she actually thought it was for a different protest that was happening somewhere else. And so her response, and I didn't understand at first, made no sense. And it didn't matter. I wasn't going to air it because it made no sense. But I loved it because Tony Danza walked up. And talk about just your consummate New Yorker actor, all around great guy. So I thought, well, everyone else has had these like wacky, really roundabout answers about walking through the protest to get to the Met Opera. And he just comes in, he's like, someone out there has got beef. And you know what? In New York, that's what you do. When you got beef, you give beef. You know, that's this whole thing. It was such a great answer. And it was like a non-answer too, but it was fabulous. And everyone thought, everyone should have just said that. He's like, that's New York.
But that's such a New Yorker like attitude. And I think sometimes people turn it on the carpet, and a lot of, especially actors and actresses, and probably even more so stage actors and actresses. So that's why you were getting all the other stuff.
Yeah. And it was interesting. He's a fun guy to interview and be around. And there's some people who, he may not be the biggest celebrity in the world, but what's amazing is I've been out and seen him at restaurants, and everyone comes over and talks to him. Everyone shakes his hand. He chats with everyone. And it is fun to still see that in New York, where so many celebrities live really more in a bubble as time has gone on. He's just out and about. Every wait person, people in the restaurant, I've seen him a few times. And I thought, well, that's great. I love that. And I'm sure now he'll be inundated, but.
Well, but you know, he, for a couple generations, he feels like you know him. I mean, whether it was through Taxi or you know him from Who's the Boss, he's just feels like a friend at this point. So I think people just feel like they know him.
Yeah. And to some extent they do. And so they're not shy. And but he's not one to say, hey, you know, I'm eating my meal or whatever. He's so friendly. And I love to still see that and see people's excitement to meet their celebrities, but who are also their fellow New Yorkers, because it's so New York.
All right. So I want to jump into our game before we go. But I also just last words of wisdom from a woman who has maintained a career for 25 years in the news, in the number one market. So what sort of wisdom can you give listeners?
I always tell myself when I'm getting down, go back to basics. When I'm feeling lost or confused, and it happens, where am I going? What's happening with my career? Like, what are the basics? What are the things that I still love? What have I always been good at? What are the stories that have been successful? So I'm not afraid to go back and say, where did I come from? How did I get to where I am? Because those are the things I have to keep going with. I have to find great stories. I have to keep up my enthusiasm. For me to keep up my enthusiasm, I know I have to find great stories. I'm not someone who can take an assignment and go, oh, okay, well, I guess this will be interesting. I need to feel that excitement. I need to get really revved up for it and bring my full excitement for the subject matter. I think the other thing is to always be in your own corner and don't be your worst enemy. So many of us have that other voice that's questioning your ability, listening to too much criticism. I have found the hardest thing over time has been to accept criticism as a positive. It's so hard, but one day I just said to myself, in this industry, people pay consultants to watch their tape and tell them what they're doing wrong. But yet if you're at work and someone says, oh, I wasn't sure about that story or that line or that piece of video, we're apoplectic about it. So I've come to tell myself every time someone gives me criticism, they're helping me and I don't even have to pay them.
This leads me to what we talked about before the show about the criticism on social media that you have to deal with.
Yes, that's a different kind of criticism that I do try to just brush off. But you do, especially as a female, get a lot of comments about the way you look. I happen to get a lot about my hair and I do laugh it off. Sometimes I might write something back. And recently someone wrote, who did your hair? Your hairdressers, you know, obviously from the big hair 80s. And I didn't write back, but I was going to write back. Well, thank you. What a wonderful compliment. Because I am from the 80s. I love 80s big hair and I am my own hairdresser.
Well, and not only that, for women in our age group, it's starting to thin for some of us. So good on you.
And you would be surprised, but a lot of times it's women who make the comments and who write to you. And that's just the nature of the world we live in, where we're all given that message that we're judged by our looks as females, in addition to other things, but that it's a big piece of the puzzle. That I try to just take with a grain of salt. But for me, one of the massive mind checks that I do is taking criticism or anything that's negative and rethinking it as a positive. A door shuts, another one opens. My mom always told me that. Anytime I got turned down for a job or an opportunity, my mom would always say, and this is her voice, well, when one door shuts, another one opens. She's like the Edith Bunker of moms with her voice. And it was always true, but each time it happens, you don't believe it.
No.
You say,
no, I go to the darkest place right away.
I'm never going to have another great opportunity. I missed that big story. Everyone else is getting ahead except me. You know, these thoughts come in, but my mom is always right. Another door does always open. And sometimes it's so much bigger and so much better. And when a door shuts, I do look back and say, what are all those other times when mom was right? Think about this time. You didn't get this. You didn't get this. Or there's been people I've almost interviewed so many times and I keep missing it. It doesn't happen. Chris Rock was that way. I've wanted to interview Chris Rock for 20 years. It was one of these things. Oh, he didn't show up. Or we thought he was going to do the carpet, but he didn't. Oh, we thought he was going to do this thing, but he wasn't. He came yesterday. You're here today. And then I get a call. I think this is 5 years ago for a Netflix junket. Would I want to do an interview with Chris Rock? Oh, with Adam Sandler. Ding, ding, ding. Yes, please. And again, it was only national media, but they invited me too. So it was this amazing opportunity. And I jumped at it. And here was someone who I'd always said, Chris Rock's going to be the one that always got away. Meantime, when it did happen, we got Adam Sandler. It was fabulous. But I waited a long time and I was really excited for that.
And you didn't slap him when you saw him?
No. I took a selfie with them, which was amazing. The worst selfie I've ever been in. It is the worst picture of me ever, but it's my favorite.
I mean,
I'm making a weird face. It's a weird angle. You wouldn't even know it's me, but I have to show it to everyone because I'm like, yes, that's me finally getting the Chris Rock interview and Adam Sandler. And it was fun to interview them together.
That's great. All right. Quickly into our game. The game is called New York One. These are number ones in New York City. I want you to tell me what they are. Okay.
Okay.
So what's the number one hospital in New York City?
Health and hospital, the state-run hospital system.
New York Presbyterian, specifically.
Okay.
Oh, okay. What's the top attraction for first-time visitors in New York?
The Empire State Building.
Statue of Liberty.
Statue of Liberty was going to be my other answer.
Okay. Next, number one industry.
Finance.
Yes. And just so you know, I did this with my husband and he also missed the other ones and got that one. So you're not alone here. Okay. Time Out New York recently named the top New York City movies of all time. Can you name three of the top 10?
Taxi Driver.
Yep. Number one, actually. Good job.
Sleepless in Seattle.
No.
I know it's Seattle, but they come. Not with Sleepless in Seattle. You've got mail. Sorry.
No, but if you think of the Empire State Building for one of them.
Oh,
I think a giant gorilla.
Oh yeah, King Kong.
Yeah.
The top New York City movies. I can't think of any of them. Okay.
What about Spike Lee?
Think it's Do the Right Thing.
All right. You got three.
Okay.
Other answers acceptable. Rosemary's Baby, Escape from New York, Dog Day Afternoon, On the Town, Something Called Shadows, and Sweet Smell of Success. I don't know some of those myself.
I'm so glad I guessed the ones I did because I would have never guessed any of the others.
Escape from New York was a favorite of mine growing up. Okay. But I don't know that I would have guessed that as a top movie. Okay. And then finally, this is not a number one. Condé Nast Traveler released the Reader's Choice for the best cities in the U.S. And this city beat New York City for the number one spot for the fifth year straight. Do you know what it is? And it's a U.S. city.
Impossible. To visit?
Yes.
Portland?
Nope. Chicago. 5 years in a row.
But I will add that most people don't know this. They've also done a lot on the friendliest cities, and people are very surprised to know that New York often rates as the friendliest city in the world. And that is because we're used to talking with each other and giving tourists directions.
Yeah. And so even though I give the wrong ones often, because I, especially in Soho, I was infamous when I worked down there to be like, yeah, that way. And then
I just go that way. But New York has many, many times been rated the friendliest city. And I'm sure a lot of people don't realize that.
All right. Well, Stephanie, it has been such a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for spending this time with me. Do you have any social channels you would like to share?
Sure. I'm at Steph Simon TV on Instagram, Twitter, and Stephanie Simon Claffey on Facebook.
All right. Well, thank you so much again. You can catch her on New York One if you're in New York City. This is the Jobs Blow Podcast. We're at jobsblowpodcast.com and at Jobs Blow Podcast on our social handles. Thank you so much.
You